Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrio.
I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school. Hey, everyone. Hope that you had a great week. We are very excited to bring you an episode today. Before we get started, Sebastian, I want to know, what is your go-to like news source? Like, if you're just going to go like on your phone, you're going to check the news, what do you use?
Okay, well, it depends on which country I want the news from. So, like, fair. Obviously, I'm a dual, so I got to take care of Peru and United States. So if I want to know about United States, I actually use an application called Winmo. And it's essentially an application that only gives you headlines that they write and nothing else. And then they can link it to a particular different kind of sources of articles. So
That's cool. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, it's pretty nice because it only gives you kind of like what you need to know for a particular topic rather than a whole take. And because they edit the headlines to not be clickbaity rather than to be like, this is the fact, it kind of like filters a little bit of that noise. And then for Peru, there is a website that I follow that is news that I follow. It's called Ojo Público, which stands for like public eye. And I really love their work, and I even donate money to them because I love their work. And that's what my go-to. Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah. What about you?
So I probably, being honest, it's New York Times, just because my university pays for New York Times subscription, so I don't have to worry about like, you know, stupid paywall after five articles or something. Yes. And then like, if I want to know something that's like, I see in there and I'm like, oh, this is happening right away, I'll like just go on Twitter and search it often.
Yeah.
Just like see what people are posting. So
I don't follow enough like general people to get my news through Twitter. Like I hear people say that, and I only get like obviously the big news, but like I get a lot of takes from Twitter, but not a lot of
news
from Twitter.
That's fair. I guess, I mean, once I see a thing, if I'm like, oh, that's interesting to me, like this whole like canal thing, then the Suez Canal, I like type it in Twitter, see what's going on. What about you, Abdul?
I'm avoiding news at this point.
It's 2021. 2020 is over.
Yeah,
exactly. No, I'm avoiding news. I have been so focused on just getting my classes going, and I found that news was distracting. So if it doesn't get to me through individual conversations, then I don't know about it.
It's almost like read a book called Make Time.
Almost. I have not, but it sounds like I should read it.
I think this is the third week in a row Sebastian has recommended this book in some way or another, so I need to read it.
We all need to.
That's funny.
Well, our special guest today is Abdullah Al-Bahrani. He's an associate professor of economics and the director of the Center of Economics of Education at Northern Kentucky University. His research focuses on the economics of education and the role of information in economic decision-making and market outcomes. He is the recipient of the very fun to say Kenneth G. Elzinga Distinguished Teaching Award and the Excellence in Teaching and Instruction Award in 2016, and got a Dean Citation Award in 2015, among many other awards. and they all recognize his passion and ability for teaching. Abdullah, thank you for being here with us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited to be here. This is one of my favorite podcasts, so it's a dream come true.
Oh, this is awesome. This is also a very nice collab for our listeners. If you guys don't know, Abdullah has a really cool YouTube channel that we'll put it down in the show notes. But I feel like this is a nice collab. Also, I have a question before we move on. I have a question for Alex, Econ Trivia. Alex, who is Kenneth Elzinga?
I just failed the trivia.
So I didn't know this until I came to UVA. He's a professor here at UVA who's been teaching principles of, I think, micro or macro for like years. Like we're talking like lots of years.
He's an institution.
And so I only know that because when I came to UVA, I was like, oh my gosh, this is Kenneth Elzinga guy. He has an award in his name. That's a big deal.
I didn't know that. He is an amazing name in addition to being an amazing instructor. Before we get into everything, we've got to know, Abdullah, what's a fun fact? Give us something to add a little color to our picture of you.
So, you know, I said, I'm a fan of the show, and I hear this question often on your podcast, and I'm always stumped because I was like, if I'm ever on the show, what will my one fact be? And I can't figure it out. But given the theme of the show and the hidden curriculum aspect of it, I'll tell you a secret of how I got through my PhD program. And this is the fun fact.
That sounds good. That sounds important.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you've talked about this before, the need to find an outlet through your PhD program, something to take you away. So I picked up photography and, you know, just try to learn as much about photography. It was a way for me to escape my office and give myself an excuse to walk around campus with a camera and pay attention to the small details that are not economic theory or, you know, data. And actually, it allowed me to find my center, if you may, get me through the PhD program. So any PhD students out there, find an outlet. Mine was photography. If you want to talk about photography, I would love to anytime.
Cool.
So I do have a question. What are you mirrorless, mirrored? What system are you in? Sebastian and I are both nerdy techno lovers, so we have many questions.
So I started with the Canon Rebel series. That was my entry level.
Me too.
DSLR. Mm-hmm. Now I shoot entirely with a mirrorless A6600 Sony. It's really good with video.
Yeah.
You know, for my YouTube channel, so it's multi-purpose. But I have several cameras laying around. But I'm gravitating mostly to the Sony A6600.
I have a question for you about your picture. Do you have a nice Instagram?
Yes. So at Dr. A Albarani. Nice is you know, up to you all to decide, but it exists. And you know, it's one of those things where I'm trying to figure out what exactly is I'm doing with the Instagram. I've tried in the past to do like little mini, I used to call them econ minis. So they're like, you know, carousels with some economic topics to just engage my students. And sometimes it's just like, hey, look, the leaves are changing color. let me write a little
poem. Well, I thought you would just put your pictures there. I didn't realize you're trying to make it educational.
You know, everything needs to be educational. It kind of goes with the brand that I'm trying to push out there.
Before we dive into today's topic, we want to hear a little bit about your work. We got some in the introduction, but we'd love to hear from you about anything that you want to promote or share with our listeners.
So research-wise, my focus is right now is on the returns to financial literacy. I'm interested in racial differences in accumulation of financial knowledge and whether financial literacy education levels the playing field. We always talk about financial literacy education as being the silver bullet that's going to solve all our lives' problems. And I'm trying to understand if that kind of helps level the playing field. And mainly my interest there is widening racial wealth gap and the role of financial literacy. So that's one area of research that I'm spending my time on. But as a Center for Economic Education director, I do a lot of pedagogy and economic education research. And that's where I spend most of my time, either doing research or reaching out to the community to do workshops. Mm-hmm. Just increasing access to and the quality of economic education, as I say, my YouTube channel.
I have a question about financial literacy education, like broadly. Yeah. Are we talking about just like, hey, this is what interest is, this is how you think about money across time? Are we thinking about like actual classes or like a course in high school or like what level are we, we mean here? Like, where do we think impact begins?
So I have a personal response and then I have a research response. The personal response, my view is financial literacy education should happen as early as possible and as often as possible. You know, I have a colleague that I recently had on my YouTube channel, Jane Wagner, and she brought up a really good point that financial literacy is only education that we provide one time and then we assess it for its efficacy. Whereas, you know, nobody says, hey, what'd you learn in 10th grade history, right? So my view is we need to provide it as often as possible. And it really fits with the curriculum. You know, if you're talking about history, history to me sounds so much better when the economics is brought to light, because economics is always in the background. As far as the research component, this is where we struggle in financial literacy research, is we don't really define what financial literacy is from an assessment or measurement standpoint.
Do you mean like, is financial literacy typically evaluated by like, did you make correct decisions? Or is it like, it's not like you take a quiz, right? As you're saying.
Well, actually there is a quiz that we kind of go to at the high school level. There's a an assessment. And then in my research, because I'm using surveys, I rely on what's called the Big Five financial literacy questions. And they're, you know, basic to us because we're familiar with the mm-hmm. questions. But the average person scores, or the average in the United States, is 59%. So the average American fails a financial literacy test as we define what financial literacy is. Mm-hmm. And then in the research, it's very subjective. Did you pay your bills on time? We define that as good financial behavior. So it's still an infant research arena. So anybody's interested in that, there's a lot of headway to make.
I love this kind of stuff. It reminds me of these questions. I teach a course that's basically like, what is health insurance? And I took a question directly from this NPR article where they go around and ask different health insurance executives and people, like, a person has this deductible, this premium, and this copay, and then they face this bill. What do they owe? And it, the same thing, I forget the stat off the top of my head, but it was like 30% of like health insurance people could answer this question. It's sort of embarrassing, but it fits right in this realm that like, this is a pretty important thing. You should probably understand it or you're going to end up paying for forever.
I was going to ask, does this mean that you are like really good with your finances and we should be asking you questions about where to...
Yeah, what stock should we get?
Yeah, I mean, that whole question, what stock should we get, right? So when we talk about finances, my students, that's what they're interested in. Like, Dr. A, GameStop, what do you think?
Yeah, right. More GameStop to the moon.
So, you know, and financial literacy encompasses more than that. And are we providing that information to the public, to our students? Can they navigate health insurance, like Alex said? Can they navigate 401ks? Can they figure out the trade-offs between renting or home ownership? Mm-hmm. You know, in the U.S., we push home ownership as arriving to this American dream. But, you know, home ownership restricts your mobility. Right. Is that something that fits into your decision-making process? Do you want to be mobile? And we don't push that enough, as you know, some of these things are subjective and you have to evaluate your own personal preferences.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I there's a peer of mine, his name is Adam Levy, and with Laura Friedberg, they have this paper where they're using data from this unnamed university on people's decisions or what plan they use for health insurance. And then they see the actual expenditures and, like, you know, to try to figure out which plan they would have, like, saved money or whatever. But then they link into their retirement insurance and, retirement 401k decisions. And it's like a really interesting paper where if you think that these people are making really good decisions on one aspect of their life, are they making decisions on this other aspect of their life? And the answer is not necessarily. And I think this gets back to the point that even if you think you're understanding one product, which is maybe retirement or health insurance, that doesn't mean you're going to understand the other products. So I can only imagine that even if you don't understand any of the products, right, like what kind of decisions we are making, and that seems super relevant.
We'd love to hear a little bit about your workflow. People love this segment. Just how do you approach day-to-day work? That could be research or teaching. We're just trying to get a realistic picture of how you get it all done.
So workflow has been something that's near and dear to me for the, you know, especially since the pandemic started. It's required all of us to figure out what we're doing as the world changes. But this is my typical day-to-day activity. 4 a.m. wake up.
4 a.m.?
Yes, 4 a.m. wake up.
Well, that's a dumb starter. No, I'm just kidding.
and everybody's like, oh, 4 a.m., you know, there you go. We can't continue this conversation. Yeah. But I just shift my daytime hours, right? Because I go to bed like 8:30. Yesterday, I had a meeting from 7:30 to 9:30. I was falling asleep in the meeting because it's like way past my bedtime.
Right.
But the reason I shift my work hours is I found that my productive time, my creative time, is like 5 to 7, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So I spend those first 2 hours of my day not talking to anybody, not, you know, sometimes I'll check email, but I use it for either writing or, you know, just creative things that require me to think out of the box. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the day is all task oriented. So I have to work out every day. I've learned that about myself. It's my mental health time. Mm-hmm. So I allocate an hour, but usually by 9 o'clock, I'm at my desk and I'm in meetings because of the Center for Economic Education. I'm in meetings from 9 till about 5, right? So sometimes back to back, sometimes I have short breaks, but I don't have that work time. And that's one thing that I miss. I miss being just, you know, strictly research oriented or teaching oriented. But yeah, my calendar, I don't own it between 9 to 5.
Wow. So that's what about prepping for classes or anything like that?
It has to happen after or, early in the morning. Yeah.
So then you have between 5 and 8 to do that kind of work. That's intense.
So I'm teaching a new course this semester and it's taken up a lot of my time and new prep.
So then a weekend's also then places, times where you work then?
Yeah, you know, just to be realistic and not to send the wrong signal, I operate under this, what I call managed chaos, right? Okay. So I have to have way too many things going on. Otherwise, if I have downtime, I don't feel like, I just feel better with more things going on. So I overcommit and I like it. But yeah, so that's my life. So usually after five. Lately, what I've been doing because of, you know, just being conscious of being sitting in front of the computer all day in Zoom calls is, and the weather is better. So now between 5 and 6, I force myself to go for a walk to kind of break the day and get away from the desk and clear my mind. It's probably one of the best things that I've incorporated.
That's an intense work schedule. And particularly when you wake up that morning, how do you pick what you're going to do with this special protected time? Like, do you pick the night before? Like, or are you just like, I'm working on this project until it's done. And I spend my time in the morning on like whatever project has your priority at the moment.
Yeah. So I have a to-do list. Keep in a notes section. I know you guys care where you keep your to-do list.
We love all the technology.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've tried Asana, I've tried all of them, but Notes is just more flexible for me. So I usually go through that. The night before, I'll create my to-do list for the next day. And the night before, I'll look at my meetings for the next day, kind of mentally prepare for them. And then you know, when I wake up at 4 a.m., I'll allow myself usually like 30 minutes to hang around. I'm a coffee drinker, so I drink a lot of coffee, espresso specifically, and then get my day started.
I'm trying to think of like the time then left to do stuff like research and YouTube. So like, does research get punted to the summer maybe, or, and then how does you embed this YouTube work in it? Because it's hard for me to think that you're not spending time on the weekends doing this because that would be super productive. So I don't know. Talk to me about that.
No. So part of my meetings are calendar blocks meetings with my co-authors to do some research.
I see. Right? I see.
Fridays tend to be calendar blocks to meet with my co-authors, connect. Mm-hmm. And the reason I have to calendar block is if I don't put it on the calendar, it gets taken up by
totally. You
know, somebody seeing that my calendar. By the way, this is the worst invention that anybody's created, that we all could see each other's calendars.
People keep saying this in the podcast, and I don't know. I don't know. How does that happen to me? I keep my calendar private.
It bothers me a lot, actually. So like, I have people, they'll be like, oh, I saw that you were free during this block, so I like added this meeting. I'm like, I don't like, should I be scheduling my sleep in this calendar? Like, I don't like,
but no, how can they see your calendar is what the thing that I don't understand.
It's Outlook.
But if I keep my calendar in Google, how can like they always
then see they'll think you're free all the time.
Yeah.
But that's dumb.
I get it. It's part of why I hate it.
Okay.
So that's pretty much my workflow. It's just calendar blocking and setting aside time for research. But, you know, the reality of it with a center responsibility, my research output is much lower than I would like. But I get rewards in other areas like outreach and impact.
Today, we want to talk about new things, quote unquote, or innovations that are happening in the teaching world. Abdullah not only has teaching awards, which is great, but also has been really connected and talking to a bunch of people in this community to teach economics. Now, lessons here don't necessarily just apply to economics. You'll see that they're applied to any kind of subject. So it could be a lot broader than that. So let's start at the beginning, as I always like to say. Can you tell us a little bit about your career path and how you got where you are exactly?
So I'll start at birth. I was born in Muscat, Oman.
Nice.
It's an important aspect because part of my career is this identity of being an immigrant of Middle Eastern nationality, of Omani nationality specifically.
Omanian? Is that the right word?
Omani.
Omani. Dang it. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. They always get you. They switch it up.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. The Omanese. You never know. Right?
Exactly. You never know. Yeah. But the fact that you asked, I appreciate that. I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. And actually, the reason I end up in Louisville, Kentucky as an Omani is my mom was doing her PhD at the University of Louisville in education.
Oh, wow.
So that's when I got introduced to graduate school and the idea of that and watched her work on her dissertation, helped her actually enter data as a teenager.
As a pre-doc.
Yeah. Exactly. But I did my undergrad at the University of Louisville in business economics. I started off actually as a chemical engineer major. I did a master's at American University. And the fun fact here is I had no idea that you could go into a PhD directly from undergrad. I thought you had to do a master's because I was getting my advice from my mom, who's in education, mm-hmm. and you know that's the path. But in hindsight, I probably was not ready for a PhD anyways at that point. Mm-hmm. So I graduated with my master's during the best times in the world, during the housing boom, between 2003, and I started selling mortgages.
Loved it.
It was a great time. Learned a lot about people, their financial decision making mm-hmm. process.
Totally.
And it actually is the reason that I went to get a PhD is because I wanted to understand what was happening in the market, because everything that I was seeing in this real world did not apply exactly the way I had learned in economic textbooks.
Your reasoning about entering the PhD sounds really interesting to me, and I want to ask you a little bit about that, which is, if I want to know more, I read a book. I don't say, I'm going to spend the next 5 years in a dirty basement doing hard algebra. It had to be a little bit more than just curiosity, no?
I think a lot of curiosity, and I was reading books and I wasn't getting what I wanted to get. And what I realized is maybe I didn't know how to seek that information. So I needed guidance in how to seek information. And it's probably the best thing that's happened to my life was going into a PhD program, just the mentorship and the guidance, especially at the University of Kentucky. Obviously, I don't know other places, but I enjoyed my time there. And yes, I feel like in hindsight, maybe at that time, I didn't know exactly what I was looking for, but the decision I made helped me get to where I want to be, right?
So that's so interesting.
As an aside, you have to have won the geographic consistency lottery here, right? For Northern Kentucky. Like that you always hear someone like, well, like I only got into one school, so I went to Alaska. And the only job I got was in Florida, so I had no family and friends near me. And you're like, you're talking drivable distances here.
Yeah,
that's phenomenal. Yeah. Like, right? So that must be intentional, right?
I've hit the three major cities in the state of Kentucky, Louisville, Lexington, and then the Northern Kentucky, which is a collection of cities.
It's just Cincinnati.
Yeah. Whoa.
I'm just kidding.
Watch out.
Cincinnati's airport is in Kentucky. All right. I'm familiar. Right? It's all just one big city to my
This
mind.
Interview's over with.
Yeah.
ended up in Northern Kentucky was not a fluke. The job came open and they were looking for an economic education, economics education specialist. And I had started to create a name for myself in that arena. So it's been a great place to be. And one of the things and the reason that I'm creating this YouTube channel interviewing economic educators is I feel in our profession, we highlight the R1 institutions a lot, and we don't highlight enough of the quality of life and the research that exists at the other types of institutions that are out there. So I think it's my role to talk about how successful you can be and how enjoyable of a life you could have outside of R1.
By the way, to our listeners, this is not just him. There is a community of people that are dedicated to this. I ran into this community I believe as a discussant on a session at Southerns. And I went into the session and I was like, oh, this is a little bit different from, you know, what I hear. It's all about how to educate when it comes to like economics. And there was just like a bunch of people that already knew each other. And they were like, you know, it was just, I was like, oh, this is a community of people that really care and are thinking really thoughtfully about this, that I guess I didn't know it existed. But I think that's just because of what you're saying right now, which is like, it's not as valuable, which is kind of weird, because then we're talking about how we're teaching. And I think maybe now there's been a shift because of social media about people crowdsourcing and asking questions of like, hey, there's an example. Then now people are starting to notice that this is something super valuable, and then that you can rely on this you know, set of in community, at least, that has put a lot of work into it.
It's one of the reasons that I have emphasized the work that I do on YouTube so much, because when the pandemic happened, everybody was searching for questions about how do we shift our pedagogy? How do we teach effectively in online education? And the voice that was not sought is all of these amazing economic educators that are out there. So, you know, it's easy to look at the community and say, hey, community, you're not listening to us. You're not coming to us. Or there's another way to look at it and say, well, hey, economic educators, have you not done a good job of communicating that you exist? Right. And, you know, I just want to make sure that I market that, hey, there is a resource out here for you if you want to know how to use Zoom to engage people.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Tell us a little bit about the innovations that you have seen. Maybe highlight a couple that you think are really interesting. And maybe I can start with one, which I think you talked about in one of your videos, which is how to use podcasts into your class and teaching.
Yeah. So, you know, podcasts are really easy way to engage students with seeing economics. I know it's a audio, but having them see the connections of what they're learning to the outside world. You as an educator, you go into your class and you give all these examples, and sometimes students don't see how that's applicable to what's happening now. They think, you know, it's Sebastian and Alex, they're, you know, they're geeky, they love econ, they see it everywhere. But how can you bring in the news? How can you bring in things that are happening? And then how can you create assignments around that? So my colleague, Rebecca Morrill at Emmanuel College, has a couple of papers, and I'll share them with you so you could include them as part of the notes, on how to use podcasts, specifically how to get students to create their own podcasts about economic concepts and news in their everyday life. And, you know, that active learning aspect has been, you know, it's been shown that students learn better when they're participating that way. So that's, you know, those are going to be good resources for somebody that's looking for that.
I have a question just logistically. So I don't have podcast assignments. I have video-based assignments in some of my classes. And I often find it like hard, like, where do I draw the line between like appropriate content versus like quality of production or presentation? What is the literature or just your own personal experience say about like, how do you like push students to enjoy the assignment without making it seem like, you know, without them wasting their effort trying to like mimic like, you know, like something is high quality, like what you produce?
Yeah, I think benchmarking is a good way of getting students to understand the quality that needs to be produced. So, you know, when you give an assignment, you always give a rubric, or sometimes you give a rubric, however way you do it. Giving them examples of previous projects kind of sets the bar of where your expectations are on quality of production. But from my standpoint, and this is something that we're taking on with some of our projects, is our students need to be able to use technology. They need to be able to communicate effectively. So can we create assignments that require them to develop those skills, right? So we always say that we're econ folks, right? Well, I mean, data visualization, presenting your information, communicating your thoughts, these are all part of being an effective economist. So I include quality as part of my evaluation process.
That is really interesting. There's a homework that I have. So I teach stats, and one year I did this audio homework in which they had to respond to a question in audio rather than writing it. And it was mildly successful in that it gets two students talking, but it was a really hard to grade it. And then they kind of just read what they would have written. And like, it didn't do the job. So then I changed it this year to an oral version of the homework where we go through the homework that they've done orally. And I kind of like pretend I'm someone who doesn't know anything about stats and have that conversation. And that's to me trying to get at this idea of like, can I train you and practice in communicating these ideas? But it doesn't get to this other point, which is like, well, but you also are going to need skills to do that when it comes to like quality of the work, right? So that's a really interesting point that you're saying there, which, you know, I guess I'm trying to train them in one thing, but I haven't thought about like, well, the other part, right? So that's interesting.
Yeah. So often when with these projects, especially semester long projects, your students start to think of you as the evaluator, and they're only now talking to you as the evaluator of their project. Mm-hmm. And to me, that breaks some of the learning process, because now students are coming to ask me, hey, how are you going to evaluate this specific mm-hmm. situation? Mm-hmm. So something that I've been experimenting with is outside judges. Right. Mm. And what I find is students now start to seek me as a resource and ask me more open-ended questions.
That's so smart.
And are these outside judges like other academics, or do you find just like smart non-academics, so they feel like they have to explain it to their audience?
Yeah, so it depends on the project. I have a data visualization project that my students just got done. The experimental class that I'm teaching this semester is, how do you access publicly available data sets? How do you create data visualizations through Tableau and other resources, and then coding in Stata? So the data visualization part of it, I'm like, you know, I've been working with these students for 5-6 weeks right now. Let me get some academics and people from the public, because the data visualization assignment is supposed to be an assignment that is accessible to somebody that's just walking by and sees your data visualization. Do you grab their attention? Do you tell them something informative? And then I add a social media component to it, because I'm a social media fan. Mm-hmm. I'm like, is it a shareable data viz?
Right.
So that's part of the rubric that the evaluators have to think about. Like, is this something that we share on their social media platforms? Mm-hmm.
So there is some structure that you give them beforehand, exactly, and they can use it. But I like the framing of them stop seeing you as your evaluator and seeing you as a research, which I think is super important. What about other kinds of innovations or new things that you're seeing in this teaching space?
I have a presentation end of May to talk to the Pennsylvania Economic Association as their keynote speaker, and they wanted me to talk about the changing landscape of education, or econ education specifically, due to COVID. So that's taking up a lot of my time, and the punchline that I'm thinking about over here and just looking around me in the higher ed is the cat is out of the bag, right? So we always keep on talking about, oh, we're going to go back to normal. I'm not sure that this virtual life is going to be much different. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to my students the other day, and they're like, oh, Dr. A, I can't wait till fall and we're in person again. And I'm like, but are you going to expect this online component to be over with? Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, of course. You know, if things are back to normal, we're back to normal. I'm like, all right, so let's go through this thought exercise. You miss class. You can't make it. What do you send me an email. What do you say in that email? And they're like, oh, you know, sorry, I missed class. I was like, that's it? They're like, yeah, that's it. I'm like, you won't say, you know, usually you would say something like, what did I miss in class? They're like, yeah, I'd want to know what I miss in class. But I'm like, but today, wouldn't you just say, why isn't the class recorded?
Right.
So this whole idea of we won't have a virtual presence once we go back to quote unquote normal is something that we are not fully understanding. So if virtual and video and audio are going to be part of our lives going forward, I really think that we need to be thinking about how to be better in front of camera, right? Mm-hmm. How do we communicate more effectively? How do we engage? How do we stop creating an hour and 30 minute presentations for our students to watch? So that's where I think a lot of innovations are going to, or at least I hope, will go from an administrative standpoint. Mm-hmm. I know at Northern Kentucky University, we're already talking about our online strategy moving forward.
So let's talk a little bit about that, which is this video component. So how I'm getting a sense of, then, if we go back, the concept of a hybrid world where there's components about the class that are great to have physical because you have a board and the explanation and the questions is mm-hmm. more natural. But then there's like this other added, you know, you know, virtual or video component. So how do you see some of that mapping into a physical class?
It's something I'm spending my time trying to think and envision. What I'll tell you, the reason why I'm spending my time is I believe this online world has increased access for our students. It's increased access for me as well as a, you know, as a researcher, academic in a regional university. I'm invited to more presentations than I've ever been invited to. And I think it's because the, you know, the cost of having me is much lower. So people are willing to take that, and just to speak economic terms here, the risk of inviting me because, you know, the cost is so low. And for my students, I'm seeing, you know, segments of our student body thrive in an online world. So I worry by going back to normal that we are not thinking about the access component. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I see us investing a lot, some institutions at a quicker rate than others, in developing the infrastructure for everything to be live streamed mm-hmm. to our students, recorded simultaneously. You know, we're talking about how to have tech support for every class. You know, some of these things that happen at larger R1 schools are being discussed in regional universities now.
The other thing too that I wanted to ask you about is, I think something that you kind of like led the march on this, which is the Econ Games. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and maybe some background of like how that came about and what other people in other universities can learn from that experience?
The story of the Econ Games is a story of listening to students. So I was advising the Econ Club at that time and just talking to students. I think it was like 8 of us in a room. And I asked them what was missing in their education. And one of the students was like, you know, I learning all these amazing things in the classroom, but I don't see the application to the business world, right? Mm. Like how am I going to have a job in a business world? And through my efforts with the Center for Economic Education and talking to industry, what I notice, and recruiting econ students as well, what I notice is the business world also doesn't know how to use undergrad econ students. Like, what jobs are we going to get them? And being in Cincinnati, I mean, Cincinnati is a big market research city. So our students technically should have a quick path into these research analyst positions, but none of the jobs had econ as you know, possible major. So if they don't have econ as a possible major, our econ students don't apply to it. So there's obviously an information issue. So we started this Econ Games, my colleague and I, Darshak Patel. Darshak's at University of Kentucky, and we said, you know what, can we bring in businesses to challenge our students to solve a problem that their employees would, right? So a data-oriented project. And for a couple of years, we had a data collaborator, 8451, which is a market research firm for Kroger. And they would bring in their data and they would ask our students exactly what they would ask of people applying to 8451 to complete like as a task. And our students would have 6 hours live right there to complete it. Mm-hmm. So you'd see students across campus scattered in front of laptops. They got their Stata. For the first time, they're dealing with, you know, 1.5 million observations. Their computers are crashing. They're trying to figure out what to do, right? And then at the end of the day, they present to the firm that we have collaborated with. And what we notice is now the firm knows what econ students are capable of. That's one. But more importantly, our students now could envision a job that they could go into, right? Mm-hmm. And this empowered them and gave them a little bit more excitement about their major. So we thought we were onto something, so we've expanded it. This year, our interest was more on the policy side of it. So we thought, let's collaborate with the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. So that's who our data collaborator was. We had 18 universities from North America and Europe, 266 students. And, you know, they competed, they presented. The prompt was, tell us something about a segment of the U.S. economy and how it was impacted by COVID. And they gave them like a huge data set with time series data. Think about everything, small business, health, stock prices, indices, and so on. And the students had to come up with an 8-minute presentation. Think of a YouTube video.
Right. That's super interesting.
That's really cool. And, you know, I like 8451 a lot. One of my econ friends from Miami of Ohio is their director of data science. But man, what a cool way to partner with the Fed. Yeah. I feel like that's just such a nice opportunity to show all the different ways to these students that the tools of economics can be applied to, you know, everything that we do as people.
Yeah, right. We're really grateful for the collaboration with the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. They made their RAs available. So our students now met RAs that, you know, hopefully they'd want to be in their position one day. So it's just my friend Darshaw calls it internship for a day, except this time we extended it to like a weekend. So it's fun. We're expanding it. We think we're on to something over here. So we're going to start to develop monthly case studies. Our goal is to have an econ games club at each university.
Oh, and then, super cool.
And then just have case studies and upskill students. I don't know about your institution, but at my institution, students really don't get to learn how to code in Stata unless they have a faculty that's going to be an advisor for a research project.
Right.
And I just think there's an equity and access issue there. So I want to make it accessible to as many people to learn how to code in Stata. So we're going to create mini courses to go with that. We have a summer data camp coming up. So,
wow.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That is great. I like that. And I think also another maybe small takeaway too is trying to craft some of those assignments in class as a mini version of those could be really super useful. I can also see, like, as you learn more about each episode of the Econ Games, that you can start creating, like, a resource where other people can go and be like, okay, I can do this just for my class, but in, like, a smaller version, which seems really, really cool and really interesting. And then there is something else that I think you're working on, and correct me if I'm wrong, but something called Econ Beats. What is that about?
Econ Beats was an old project that I had started, and the idea was, can we get students to, this is for principal level courses specifically, can we get students to think about the language of economics in a more creative way? So I challenged my students to remake popular songs into economic terms, right?
Okay.
And talking about production, the production quality, what we did to make it transdisciplinary, because it's important to know the language of your institution and the institution at NKU at that time, our theme was transdisciplinary education. Mm-hmm. So I reached out to my colleagues in electronic media and broadcasting and said, can we make this a joint project? Your students shoot the video. My students write the lyrics and perform the song. And at the end of the semester, we all would meet up in what we call the digitorium, big auditorium, digital screen. And then we would watch, I think it was 8 to 10 videos a semester. And then they would vote, poll everywhere, top three. And then we would have judges to rank them first, second, and third. But it was a way to get people to think of economics beyond the, you know, that whenever you talk to anybody about economics, what do they say? Oh, I have a friend that took economics. Oh my God, you're taking economics. That's a horrible subject. I wanted to change that language, right? How can we make economic the buzz? And, you know, we had high school students start to attend this end of semester. It was a good recruiting method. Right. I had to stop Econ Beats because my teaching load dropped, and I just didn't have that many students to be able to do
it. If people want to find more about this topic, to learn, where do you think you want to send them? Like, what's a good place to start?
I mean, if you want to talk about traditional ways, my website, AbdullahAlbarani.com. If you're on Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, all of them have the similar handle, at Dr. A. Albarani. You know, a large part of what I do is outreach, teacher workshops. If you're interested, I'm always up for a conversation.
Thank you so much for those insights. Every week, we like to ask our guests for our recommendation of the week. This can be anything, a podcast, a command, an app, a song, a quote, a book, kitchen recipe, anything that improves your life in a small way. Abdullah, what is your recommendation of the week?
My recommendation is something that I swear by, and that's Paperlike for my iPad.
Oh, yeah.
What is this? Say it again.
It's Paperlike. It's a screen protector that adds a little bit of friction to your pen on the iPad, so that it feels like you're actually writing. One of the biggest issues I had, you know, especially shifting to virtual, is graphing on an iPad just didn't feel natural. That feeling was a little bit off. Paper-like adds that friction and makes it easier for me to draw properly.
That's cool. I never heard of that. I will buy that and check it out because I have the same gripe when I'm like teaching, right? It's like I'll go too fast and then the lines will be all weird.
Right. Yeah. It's also something that I see a lot in YouTube. It's on YouTube.
It is.
I know about it, but I've never seen it. I'm glad that you now endorse it as well because I've always been interested about it. So that's good. Alex, what about you? What is your recommendation of the week?
So mine is very simple, and I'm actually surprised I've never given it before. Since mid-college, maybe like 2007 or something, I've been using the same kind of pen, and it's a cheapo kind of pen, and I love it. It's called the Uniball Power Tank, and it's like just simple. It's not like $10 or something. Right. You can buy it on Amazon, but it writes upside down. It's like the ink is waterproof, like – it clicks real nice. I don't know. Like, it's just like a good quality pen. And it's like, I think it costs like 75 cents or something. Oh. And I don't know. I don't want to use another kind of pen ever again.
Awesome. We're also not sponsored by them. So this is,
we'll take the money though.
We'll take the money if you want to sponsor us.
Yeah. What about you, Sebastian?
My recommendation of the week. So I think I'm going to go with something aesthetic, a little bit different. So I really love a good aesthetic to get to work. Like, I like my desk to be clean and to look kind of cool. And if you're into that, my recommendation is to check D Brands. So the letter D and then Brands. And really, it's just like color stickers for your devices, like your laptop or your Apple Pencil and your iPad. Why would you do this? Well, if I'm going to stare at the top of my laptop the whole time, I want it to be something at least entertaining and happy. So mine is a bright yellow. I can't show you guys in the podcast. But I also have, like, for example, my Apple Pencil with the skin that looks like a pencil. And I don't know. It's just fun. It's all aesthetic. Yeah, it's a little bit of money, but it improves my life in that I like seeing how that works. And then people are always like, oh my gosh, is that an actual pencil? And I'm like, no, it's my Apple Pencil. So that will be my recommendation of the week. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today. Well, if people wanted to find more about your work, you're ready to give us a link. So we'll put all of those in the show notes. That's all that we have for you folks today. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review. And thank you for tuning in. Bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for having me.